This is Post Carbon Radio, and our guests today are Elizabeth Ferguson and Jeremy Lint. I met Elizabeth and Jeremy in their home in Nicasio, where they held a salon for, was it 350 Marin?
Yes.
Yes. And I had heard that they were going to go to COP21, the climate negotiations in Paris, that just finished December this last week. And so let me introduce our guest today. Elizabeth Ferguson has a PhD, is founder of Climate Compassion, an organization that engages community in climate activism, systems thinking, and wisdom practices. She is a facilitator and educator in the practices of resilience and well-being, combining the wisdom of psychology, contemplative science, internal martial arts, and neuroscience. She offers an approach to climate activism that weaves self-compassion, social justice, and community building. And Jeremy Lint, her husband and partner, is an author and founder of the nonprofit Leology Institute. And Jeremy says he's passionate about doing his part to make a difference in humanity's future trajectory. I've come to believe that our global society needs a transformational shift in our underlying values, and if we want a sustainable and flourishing future for the human race. So you sound like a great partnership, and so glad you went to Paris. Let's just start off with what happened in Paris, and how about Jeremy?
Yeah, sure. So I guess when we actually, it was a few months before COP21 was happening, it really came into our awareness as we were involved in 350.org sort of general update. And the sense that I had was that this was really going to be a historic moment, like with a real possibility of it being a turning point. And even though we weren't directly involved with one of the organizations in terms of going there to represent a particular organization, we really wanted to go there as engaged citizens. And once, as we were deciding whether we should sort of commit the time and obviously use up the carbon to fly there and all those kind of issues, what we really decided is that if we were going to go, it should be with the intention of kind of amplifying the energy and the voices that were there so we could really try to make a difference, small as it might be, to really sort of push forward some of the intentions that were driving us there in the first place.
And when you ask me what happened in Paris, I see at least two streams. There was the official stream of what happened inside COP21 itself, in the Blue Zone and with the international agreement. And then there was the people's movement alongside that. And I think what was so inspiring and heartening was to see part of what happened in Paris was an international movement come together in a way that was visible to the rest of the world that I don't think ever happened quite in this way before. And I saw quite a bit of collaboration, solidarity, connection, and exchange among just both international coalitions, international groups, people representing climate justice in the Global South, indigenous people, women, the rights of nature, as well as big groups like 350, Jeremy said, Sierra Club, Greenpeace, etc. And to me, this is something that was, this was an important historic moment for the people's movement.
We should mention that the terrorist attack that happened a couple of weeks before the COP started, which probably put a damper on a lot of civil society action, because I myself thought there could be a million people on the streets, but the police banned all the marches, as I understand.
Yeah, that's right, and that added a huge amount of complexity to the planning for what would be going on there, as well as just sort of working through the turbulence during the time there. And it's kind of interesting to look at the ways in which things evolved. Like, after those attacks, there was somewhat of a fear that really the whole attention of the world might move away from the whole issue of climate change, which we see as so central to the to our sort of global future. And we noticed, like, there was, a powerful reframing took place, which is to even sort of cast the whole of COP21 as really like a peace conference, that what it was really about, so much of the turmoil that we experienced with terrorism and all of the things that feel so unstable in our lives right now, and so much of that can be traced back to climate change and the sort of increases in droughts and just the incredible displacements that not only have gone on so far, but really just are a precursor to what could be orders of magnitude more extreme in the future decades. So I think that was a really important framing that people took very seriously during the conference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think there was definitely a feeling of just an out. I think what's interesting was that injected into civil society was a really a very heartful sense of a memorial to the people who had lost their lives, and I think it created like a poignancy and an urgency, and it's a very heartfelt collaboration among civil society. So I think that that had an impact. Like you said, the framing was really important. I think the feeling of it was that this kind of violence is actually related to climate change, as Jeremy said. And I do agree that the state of emergency prevented people who would have come in from all over Europe. So we agree there would have been hundreds of thousands of people on the streets. And instead, I think we had 10,000 people with the human chain on November 29th before the COP began, and estimated 20,000 on December 12th, the day the agreement was actually signed, with the idea that civil society would have the first word and the last word on the COP. But what I do think is nice is that there were solidarity marches all over the world on November 28th or 29th, and those were highly publicized, as well as there were actions like the shoes on Place Publique on November 29th in Paris, the Human Chain, and the Red Lines demonstration, and the demonstration near the Eiffel Tower on December 12th, that I think also were publicized, and the word was able to get out.
Tell us a little bit more about the Red Lines. I think that's very important and ironic, as you mentioned, that the official channel was sort of the blue rooms or something, right? So there was the official blue, and then what was the Red Line?
I believe the idea was first proposed by Naomi Klein, with this idea that there are red lines we cannot cross, and that civil society would hold those red lines if heads of state and international agreement would not. And the idea with what happened at COP21 is that, yes, there was an international agreement, and that is good, and I believe that really does change the frame, and yet the agreement is completely inadequate and not legally binding. And so civil society really does have to hold these red lines we cannot cross. And I think that can mean different things to different people, but I think one of the red lines is that we can't burn more than 20% of fossil fuel, known fossil fuel reserves. So we really have to keep it in the ground. So there's a big movement to halt extraction, for example.
Yeah. You know, something I'd like to add to that is I haven't seen any recent analysis, but I think that 20% number that we, a number of people have now become familiar with, was based on saying that that was to maintain global temperatures to below that 2 degrees Celsius rise. And now that, I think perhaps the most significant step may have come out of COP21 is the world leaders agreeing that actually that's not sufficient, that we have to really target more like a 1.5 degrees Celsius rise in temperature, or as close to that as we can get. And considering the fact that we're already at a 0.9 degree rise in temperature from pre-industrial levels, that actually gets to be a pretty significant target. And so one thing we might discover, and I'm sure that people doing the analysis right now, is that it's not even just that 80% of the carbon that we know of in the ground is unburnable, but that number may be even closer to 85 to 90% if we want to really hit that 1.5 degree Celsius rising temperature target. And that means really drastic changes that need to happen to our global economy, and very rapidly. And that's where I think, you know, so much of where the significance of COP21 is going to be felt in the ensuing months.
Well, I understand in this COP that there were voluntary commitments, and I think they were called intended national contributions. And if they were added up, they would get us over 3 degrees in temperature, which would be quite disruptive climate-wise.
Well, you know, I think I would even say that that kind of climate rise, if we actually were to experience that by the end of the century, it would be far more than quite disruptive. It would really, I think, raise the distinct serious possibility of the end of civilization as we know it, because of the massive amount of disruption that would happen to sort of every aspect of the whole globe. In terms of massive coastal cities just getting inundated, the interiors of continents dry up so much that you'd have widespread droughts. And so I think that, to me, the most significant step coming out of COP21 is this recognition by leaders of the inadequacy of their own commitments. I mean, it's a strange thing in a way where it's like they set the bar so low and to get an agreement so they could call it a success. And that's where these sort of intended numbers came from, so they could at least make sure everyone was in agreement. But then by recognizing the need to reach a number that is so far below where their current levels are, to me, I see it almost as an invitation that the leaders of the world put out to us, to the people of the world, to just push them, to drag them to a completely different place than they have the political power to get us to right now.
Mm-hmm. And I think that those of us in the Global North have a special responsibility. One of the things that was striking to me is speaking with someone from the Philippines who said, you know, Typhoon Haiyan happened at 0.87 Celsius temperature rise, and since the COP, there's been another major typhoon in the Philippines. So I feel that, you know, already catastrophic climate change and disruption is happening in the global south. Already there are droughts. Already there are estimated 250,000 people a year who die due to climate change. And I think that these people, part of the Demand Climate Justice Coalition, have been really trying to push leaders to say, look, we need a more ambitious agreement. We really need to take strong action. And, you know, it still didn't happen with COP21. So I feel that those of us in the Global North, particularly those of us in the U.S., because of our obstructive Republican in Congress, really have a special responsibility to be the ones who are pressuring our leaders to really make a change, and to, you know, in civil society, both building a very strong resistance movement to the fossil fuel industry, and also building a strong movement of the future that we want to create, through building resilience, through positive approaches to decentralized, democratized, renewable energy, food security, etc.
You're listening to Post Carbon Radio. We are talking with Jeremy Lent, and you just heard the voice of Elizabeth Ferguson. We're talking about their visit from the Northern California area to the COP in Paris this past month. And Jeremy is the author of a blog post entitled COP21, Is the Jubilation Warranted? Elizabeth, do you have any resources online that you would like to point people to?
Thank you. I have a website called climatecompassion.org. We hold salons in the San Francisco Bay Area, and soon I'll be posting more resources about resilience practices for climate and other social justice activists.
Great. And I'm going to jump in, unless, do you have other questions?
Oh, I was just going to mention that in last week's the Democratic and Republican debates, not one question regarding climate change was asked. How pathetic is that?
Yes, I couldn't agree. It's such a disappointment right after the sort of the whole world's attention got focused on that at COP21. And I think it just points to the necessity for just broader and deeper and more committed citizen engagement in raising awareness in mainstream thinking of how drastic these issues are. And I'm very confident that we're going to see a lot more of the kind of citizen actions that will hit sort of mainstream consciousness now in the next few months, in the next year or two, than we've ever seen before. And in a way, what COP21 has done is given license to those actions to take place, because the leaders of the world themselves have said, we don't have an adequate plan to avoid real catastrophe later in the century. That's the official position that's come out of COP21. So it feels like we need to make sure people become more and more aware of that until it's just this natural part of everyone's sort of day-to-day discourse.
Mm-hmm. Jeremy, I feel obligated, this is Karin, I feel obligated to ask the cynical question, which is from a longer-term perspective of multiple COPs, that civil society has been doing a lot of that work for a long time. And so what is to make us believe that this time it's different? Or what is to make us believe that doing more of the same type of action is going to have the effect that so far hasn't come out in the binding and fair agreement that people were asking for, certainly as far back as Copenhagen? Or are we doing different actions now than years ago?
Super question, Karin. And, one way in which I would look at that is with the realization that when the changes that happen in society oftentimes tend to be non-linear. And so if we sort of just like look at the past and see the way, like sort of just draw a line from the past, if we just draw a straight line going forward, then it would lead to real sense of despair, in a sense, in terms of like we just haven't seen the changes that need to be done. And in terms of just the basic things like fuel usage, just over 10, 20 years, we've seen virtually no, such a tiny increase in renewables and stable amount of fossil fuels. But the thing that gives me hope is that non-linearity of changes that do happen in society. And we've seen that throughout history, just in terms of things like the campaign to end slavery in the last century, or just even more recently, it was only a few years ago that pretty much anybody would have said that something like the legalization of same-sex marriage is not going to happen in our lifetime. Maybe sometime in a generation or two from now, but no way. And then suddenly something shifts. There's like a moment, a transitional shift, and all of a sudden you see a completely different direction in what people take as a norm. And my personal belief is that we're experiencing exactly that kind of shift right now when it comes to climate change and the changes that need to take place. So I think that we I have a ton of hope for what can happen, even while I think we have to recognize that the changes that do need to take place are really major. They're really going to be drastic changes.
Yeah, I think it's important to navigate between a sense of hope and optimism and a certain sense of kind of self-congratulation that I think we saw after the COP. So I think it's really important not to say, well, great, there's a citizens' movement, it's going to be fine, but to say, actually, we need to bring every ounce of creativity, motivation, and really collaboration and connecting with many, many people who really aren't involved yet. We need to bring all of that to make this kind of transformation. So I think it's really important to not come from a place of just such despair that we can't act, but also not sort of a false optimism. I think that in terms of things that might be a little bit different, I think that there are a couple of things. 350 is organizing a big set of actions called Breaking Free in May, and I think we're going to see an unprecedented coordinated fossil fuel resistance that is different, and I think that will put be put on the radar. And I don't know to what degree it's happened before, but I know that Indigenous peoples are just absolutely committed, really, to drawing the red line. In fact, Tom Goldtooth has said, Indigenous leader had said that we're drawing the red lines with our bodies, that we will just not allow extraction to take place. So there is a sense that there is a growing movement. I also think that linking with some of the social justice movements that we've seen arising, such as the Black Lives Matter movement, I think with Bernie Sanders, whether or not he wins the presidency, that the kind of social change that he's creating, the kind of conversations that he's creating about big money and politics, that there are a number of openings here for social change that dots are connecting also between the climate activism movement and social justice movement, that I think is building a very, very potent opportunity for transformation.
You mentioned you heard a bit from Indigenous peoples. I would think they're quite disappointed that the rights of Indigenous peoples wasn't mentioned in the text.
Exactly. It's just absolutely abominable, really. I believe that they're just mentioned briefly in the preamble, but not in Article 2.2, which is the operative text. And I think what's really at stake is, and this is one of the things that I learned, is that, you know, listening to so many Indigenous people talk about their rights, you know, they're not really talking about property rights in the way that we might think of owning property. They're really talking about the right to protect ecosystems that are the very basis of sustainable life on Earth. And so, it's really the Indigenous right to a way of life that's in harmony with all of life, with Pachamama, with Mother Earth. It's devastating not to have those rights recognized, and I think what was at issue is having those rights recognized would create a legal basis for either obstructing fossil fuel extraction or even, some of the seeking damages for the damage that's been done to some of the territories.
And Jeremy, I know you attended a tribunal on the rights of nature. Could you tell us something about that?
Sure, yeah, absolutely. That's something that we were both at together. And it was actually not the first one that I attended. There was one that was held here in the Bay Area in Oakland a year or two ago. And I actually found it very moving to be part of this, just be there as a witness in this tribunal. It was essentially a formal kind of tribunal where you actually had 13 judges, and the concept was that there should be, just like there are legal and human rights that are recognized at the United Nations, there really are rights to nature that should be given equal legal standing. And essentially what this tribunal was about was sort of prototyping what it would actually look like if there was legal standing to these rights of nature and how that would affect the sort of discourse and the way in which we understand what is right and what's wrong in the world. So you had particular cases such as the sort of exploitation of oil fields in some of the indigenous lands of Ecuador or Peru, or things like the tar sands exploitation in Canada. And you actually had witnesses, human witnesses, for the actual impact of those, and witnesses for what was happening to the natural world. And actual judgments were made, and legal arguments were made on these topics. And the reason why I feel that's so important is that even though none of this kind of obviously has legal standing right now, it really gives us a sense of where we can and need to be headed as humanity and in the future in order to find a sustainable path for us in our relationship with nature.
Yeah, it's a completely different worldview. And I think it's the kind of worldview that we need to sustain. And so it's just an expression of a worldview that it's almost like a worldview from the future that we could be inhabiting, and it's an expression of that. And I love it. It's almost like an asynchronistic expression of a worldview of sustainability, it invites us to participate in that, even though it doesn't, it's not really consistent with the way the world is run right now or governed.
And just to sort of add on that, is this notion that for people just hearing about this for the first time, it might seem almost like this people living in fantasy land or whatever. Like, you know, how could you come up with these ideas that are so far from what our sort of day-to-day life is about? But then if you just go back not too far in history, it was just a couple of hundred years ago that Thomas Paine wrote this book, The Rights of Man, and you know, he almost went to jail in England, except he was outside of England right there when they were trying to arrest him, for coming up with these revolutionary ideas that were just had never been heard of before. And now, of course, we take things like sort of human rights as being a bedrock of what our values and principles are based on. So there is a sense that we are on this journey towards widening our sense of what sort of community and human ethics are all about.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you said that, Jeremy. I'm hearing a number of threads drawing together, and I'd like to try to draw them together and then get both of your comments on that. When you talk about the tribunal and the rights of nature and how formal it was, it almost sounds to me like a form of practice, like you said, Elizabeth, of something we might be doing in the future. And Jeremy, you said that, you know, things can change in a nonlinear fashion. And I agree with that. I think from the work of, say, Chris Hedges, we hear that in his coverage as a New York Times reporter, say, the former Soviet-allied governments of Eastern Europe and others that ultimately came to a crisis of legitimacy seemed unchangeable, sort of impermeable, impenetrable, until the day they fell, and then it was over. And not that we would necessarily have that exact political experience, but it does strike me that on the one hand, as you said, the COP seemed engineered to allow the leaders to hold hands and raise them and have a photo op moment of success, precisely because they knew they couldn't get a really successful deal, so it was designed to make it look like a success. And that that's happening at a time when even the European governments are somewhat having crises of legitimacy as the financial crisis continues to sort of roll around Southern Europe, as now the Syrian crisis and the ongoing war on terror that hasn't really worked for 15 years is now causing a continental crisis in Europe in terms of refugees and governments not really knowing how to respond. And now seeing climate change that the governments are kind of saying, or I heard you say, the governments are sort of saying, we don't really have a deal, we don't really have a solution. And then at the same time, not to romanticize indigenous people, but that around the world there are cultures that have retained this thread of an entirely different worldview, as you said, Elizabeth. And they're sort of holding on not only to their land and their ability to control and manage that land in their traditional ways, but also to a worldview. And it makes me think of the San Andreas Accords in Mexico after the Zapatista uprising, that the indigenous people actually got a sort of sub-polity. They got some local autonomy. In Bolivia, it's the plurinational state of Bolivia, which recognizes multiple political entities within it. So I wonder whether you see, both of you, the seeds of the new in these very old traditions, and whether you see those as points of hope as we move toward a lurch toward a future of, as you said, more instability, more crisis, but potentially also more opening.
Yeah, absolutely, Karen. I couldn't agree more. I feel that was very beautifully said. And I do feel that in the end, it has to be about shifting the underlying worldview more than anything if we're going to change the direction that our civilization is taking. Because, you know, there's even a scenario where climate change itself could be solved. Say, for example, with really drastic prices, price on carbon that comes out of the ground or whatever, that then totally changes people's buying decisions or whatever around the world. And climate change being solved without necessarily solving some of the underlying problems that have to do with the imbalance between humanity and the rest of the natural world. And so we have things like the sixth extinction taking place. We have things like a huge looming crisis in the availability of fresh water, crisis in just the amount of wild land available everywhere in the world, crisis in the oceans, like extinction of, and just a massive loss of fish in the ocean. And when you look at all these, it's almost as though trying to fix each of them one at a time is a little bit like having a computer that where the software has lots of bugs. You keep trying to fix the bug with a patch, and then you have another problem. You try to fix another bug. But unless you go to the operating system itself, all you're doing is actually creating even bigger and more complex problems for you to fix later on. And I think that's where it really is going to be something we need to do more and more of as we move forward, is to look at the worldview itself, the underlying values that lead our civilization onto the course it's on, and to look at those things shifting in order to have a true long-term sustainable future for ourselves in the world.
Mm-hmm. Elizabeth, would you like to follow up on that?
Yeah, thank you. One of the things that I think is interesting is there's a formulation called Buen Vivir that comes out of South America and is based quite a bit on an alternative to Western development as well as indigenous perspectives. And yet it's also a new formulation. It's not something that only comes from the past. And I think that part of this new worldview that, you know, we're emerging into, it's not like, you know, anybody I think knows exactly what that is, but I think this new worldview is looking at consonances between, you know, wisdom that does come from generations and generations and generations and tens of thousands of years of living and observing systems, living systems and biodiverse systems. I think that there's a consonance between that and systems thinking and systems science. And also that there is something about just a true love for nature and for each other and a true compassion for the suffering that's happening. So I do think there is like this possibility of Buen Vivir, which is really good living or living well, that an inquiry into that from the smallest scale within ourselves, our relationships with our close ones, our communities, to large ecological systems, that we can begin to live our way into this new worldview. Like Rilke says, you know, living the question. That we can live our way into that this is really what's required of us in this multidimensional way, as you said, Jeremy, that it's really beyond just climate disruption, but it's really looking at this way of balance within ourselves and really, I think, living in well-being for ourselves and all systems.
I think with that, we can wrap it up. I'd like to give you an opportunity to give us your websites where people can follow up on your work. Elizabeth, I believe your website is climatecompassion.org.
That's right.
And Jeremy, yours is patternsofmeaning.com.
Yes, and that is a blog that I keep. And I'd also like to just let people be aware of the website that's leology.org, that's L-I-O-L-O-G-Y, leology.org. And that is this non-profit institute, I started called the Leology Institute, which does a lot of what we were just talking about. It looks at the possibility of a new kind of worldview that integrates ancient wisdom with modern systems thinking to find a more sustainable way of recognizing humanity's relationship with the natural world and our intrinsic interconnectedness.
Karen, do you want to say anything before we wrap up?
No, I just wanted to thank our guests, Jeremy Lent and Dr. Elizabeth Ferguson, have been our guests. And Jeremy is the recent author of COP21, Is the Jubilation Warranted? On his website, patternsofmeaning.com.
Thank you again for joining us, Jeremy and Elizabeth.
All right. And in our next segment, we are very pleased to be joined by Tom Athanasiou of EcoEquity. Tom, are you on the line with us?
I am, Karen.
All right. Well, Tom's been very patiently listening to our pre-recorded segment. So the first thing I'd like to do before we get into talking about EcoEquity is hear if there's anything that you're just burning to say about the last interview.
I'm good.
Okay. Well, I want to let people know EcoEquity has been around for, what, 10 years now or so, Tom?
Actually, a bit longer than that. It just burbles along, about 15 years.
All right. Well, congratulations. And EcoEquity, as you might guess, works on the fair share of responsibility for dealing with the costs of climate change. Originally, as I recall, you worked on what were called greenhouse development rights, and now you're working on the Climate Equity Reference Project. Can you tell us a little bit about what that is, what climate equity is, and how your organization promotes it?
Right. I mean, the goal of the project is to talk about ways of understanding fairness within the context of the global transition. And we specifically mean economic fairness and developmental justice. And the greenhouse development rights framework, which is a quantitative framework, by the way, was our first cut at that, but we've tried to raise our game before it, in the year before Paris, and part of that is joining together with other organizations, and we had quite an alliance in Paris, including some very large organizations that joined with the Climate Equity Reference Project to do an analysis of the national pledges. And so it's basic. The basic idea is that, you know, in 1992 at the Earth Summit, there was a framework convention agreed, the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, and it contained some high-level justice principles. And so we asked the question, you know, what do those justice principles mean in terms of what national fair shares to the effort, the global effort that will be necessary. How does that shake out? And use that to you know, inform our sense of the national pledges, the INDCs. You know, which countries are pledging to do enough, which pledges are really falling short. And just to back up one second, what this is about is the idea that this is a commons problem, a global commons problem, and the hardest global commons problem we've ever faced, and that commons problems can be solved. You know, we have a terrific, we're intelligent animals and cooperative animals, but they can only be solved if people feel that other people are being tolerably fair. If people feel they're being exploited or taken advantage of, commons regimes collapse. And so it's not just a question of what is fair from an abstract perspective. It's a question of what is fair from the perspective of supporting a robust enough approach to national cooperation to make it through the coming transition, which is going to be, let's just say it's going to be stressful.
Yeah. Well, and I assume that when you're talking about what's fair and just, that it includes all the aspects, right? It includes mitigation. It includes adaptation. And
it includes loss and damage.
And loss and damage, which I understand was taken out of the final Paris Agreement. Is that correct?
No, that's not correct.
Okay.
The loss and damage article is in the Paris Agreement, and from that perspective, it was a major step forward. What has been taken out is, at the insistence of the United States, by the way, and I'm not a U.S. basher. I mean, There's a lot of people who want to blame the United States for everything, and there's lots of approborum to go along. But on the particular question of legal liability for loss and damage, it was the United States, I'm afraid, that insisted that that be taken out of the agreement text. And this is going to be a matter of great concern going forward. And the lawyers are arguing about exactly what it means. But loss and damage itself has been recognized by the agreement. So that's a step forward.
But it's confusing to me. If there's no liability for loss and damage, what does that mean? What remains?
That is exactly the question that is on people's minds. I mean, it might mean that for example, of all the money that goes into the Green Climate Fund in any given year, a certain fraction of that money is earmarked for loss and damage related activities, but that there cannot be legal challenges made to say that a government must pay.
So it's an option; it's not required.
It's an attempt to foreclose liability-based judicial actions.
Okay. Well, so we were talking a little bit before this interview to sort of frame it, and I asked you what your, you know, how the terrorist attacks and being in Paris for the COP and then having the terrorist attacks, how the civil society response, you know, affected you, and you said that might help frame our conversation. What did you mean by that?
Well, I think that you know, it's, you know, I think you know a bit about the history of this process and how it often has been compared to a kabuki play in which every country, every national negotiating team, every NGO team comes with its lines prepared and delivers its lines, and there's not a lot of listening, not a lot of real negotiating going on. A strange, alienated sense of going through the motions. There was less of that this year, and the terrorist attacks were, I think, part of the reason. There was a sense of moral seriousness over Paris, and it wasn't just the terrorist attacks. It was the fact that Paris really was a make or break moment in the climate negotiations, and it was 6 years after Copenhagen, and Copenhagen, long story, but you know a bit of it. You know, it was a mess, and if Paris was another mess on top of the terrorist attacks, you know, it would have fed into the sense that there was no adult supervision, that the whole notion of global multilateral governance had just been, you know, a strange dream, but that we were really going to be careening into a dark, no one wanted it. People wanted to rise to the occasion. And there was, you know, that was one of the factors. The terrorism, the other thing was that Paris had to succeed. I mean, you know, some people are saying that Paris was contrived to look like a success. No doubt there's some level on which that's true, but actually, Paris was a success, and it was a strange and interesting phenomena because it had to be a success. It's the moral equivalent of war. You know, it's not a joke, and the terrorist attack made that somehow front of mind.
Well, Tom, this is Bing. Hi.
Hi, Bing. How are you?
Pretty good. Well, I understand there were a lot of things left out of the negotiations too. Can you say something about that?
Oh God, there were so many things left out. I think that the two biggest things were the dynamics of what people call the ratcheting mechanism, by which ambition is going to be increased over the years, and the finance, the details of the financing mechanism, which is part of the ratchet, and then a million other things. But I would rather start by saying that a couple of really, really good things happened. One thing that happened was that we got a universal climate treaty. And this should, as a political matter, this should not be underestimated. You know, the fossil fuel cartel has been very successful in attacking the climate negotiations by saying that, you know, only some countries were coming under pressure to pay and to change. And that's not going to wash anymore. This is a global framework and everybody's in. And morally, politically, economically, this is a big difference. And another thing that happened is that as the meeting went on, there was more consensus that the 1.5 degree centigrade degree temperature target had to be inscribed into the goal of the agreement, and it's there now. It's the language is a little weaker than it could be, but it's a real challenge. It's a real challenge to us all, because to get anywhere near that goal, we need a vast and wonderful global mobilization. And so the question of how that's going to happen is really hanging in the air now. So good things, and the loss and damage article is in the agreement. What it's going to mean going forward is yet to be determined. The need for a financing mechanism is in the agreement, a financing mechanism that scales up from the $100 billion a year that Hillary Clinton promised in Copenhagen in 2009. So, you know, you have to remember the Paris Agreement goes into effect in 2020. There are 5 more years of negotiating between now and then, or maybe 4, depending on how you count it. And the agenda for this next 5 years has now been set, and step 1 is early action. What happens between 2016 and 2020? But then during that period of time in which we are going to be hopefully building momentum, a lot more has to be negotiated. And the great thing about the Paris Agreement is that while there are big holes in the text, there are also many, many hooks in the text which can be used to fill those holes. You know, I don't want to say that the international negotiations are going to save our bacon, because by themselves they could not possibly do so. But they're the missing piece of the puzzle that we haven't had on the table in the last 5 or 10 years. You know, the movement is growing by leaps and bounds in both sophistication and influence. And the technology revolution is coming along very, very well. There are some big holes in the renewable technology portfolio, but there's active research to fill those holes. You know, next generation grids, you know, large scale affordable solar storage being two prominent examples. But the international negotiations have been jammed. They've been deadlocked for 2 decades now, and Paris, cross your fingers, but Paris appears to have broken the deadlock. And if we can just keep going from here, it's not over by any means, but if we can just keep going from here and building momentum, we're going to be in a really, really better place than people had feared we would be. And that's good news, and I think we ought to recognize it.
All right, Tom, I'm going to jump in because you've said a lot, and I want to make sure I understand. So the deadlock that's been broken, is that the fact that the agreement was universally approved? Is that the main breakthrough?
Right, well, yes. The question now is not a question of a small number of countries paying the incremental costs for all countries globally. The question now is, how are we going to understand national fair shares for all countries, which is my topic, right? So I'm very excited about this. And it really is true that national fair shares are on the table. And the question is, how do you understand them in such fair shares in terms of historical responsibility, in terms of income inequality, in terms of national capacity to pay? How do you understand national capacity? You know, what kinds of economic rights do people have? Is there a right to sustainable development? If so, what does it mean? Do the poorest have basic energy rights and basic food security rights? If so, how do we understand those rights, and how are they going to be operationalized? And these are really big issues, and they're not deadlocked anymore by this static framework of having some countries be the Annex One payer countries and other countries being assumed treated as if they're always going to be developing countries. So that's what I mean by the breakthrough.
Okay, so the Annex One, non-Annex One system was broken, and something else was put in its place.
Something else to be determined has been put in its place.
And the next 4 or 5 years, are those negotiations to answer the questions you just asked and fill out what's the blanks in the Paris Agreement, or is that going to be negotiating for whatever the next round is and the next city is?
No. It's to fill in the blanks in the Paris Agreement.
Okay.
The Paris Agreement basically replaces the Kyoto Protocol, which was negotiated in 1997, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the Paris Agreement gives us a framework within which there are going to be annual decisions made to fill out the details. I mean, what we got in Paris is the agreement and then an initial set of decisions, but there's going to be more decisions every year under the framework of the Paris Agreement and the older framework of the 1992 Framework Convention. So it's building out a pretty sophisticated global apparatus.
Tom, I'm concerned about the binding aspect. Countries can promise to do something, but how do we hold their feet to the fire?
Well, Bing, that's a really, really good question, and you have to start by recognizing the reality that there is no global government, no global Leviathan. And so the question is, exactly, how do you do that? What does it even mean for there to be national legal obligations if there is no way of enforcing these obligations? You know, Canada was legally obligated under the Kyoto Protocol to do a number of things, but its government changed and it walked away from the Kyoto Protocol, and there were no legal or political consequences. That's the problem we have. Everybody's always talking about legal bindingness. But what does legal bindingness mean in the absence of global government?
You know, we're down to our last minute or so, unfortunately. There's so much more to talk about, but I think you've helped clarify some fundamental concepts. And I just want to say what you just talked about, which is in essence is the fact that the international world is not, there's no global cop, right? I mean, in the sense of police person, not in the sense.
Yeah, that's right.
And you also said in our pre-interview that we're now in a more variegated, dynamic, and polarized world as we face the climate crisis. So what's the challenge and what's the opportunity there in 30 seconds?
Yeah, in 30 seconds, we live in an incredibly economically polarized world, which is careening towards catastrophe, as you know. And we have to deal with the climate crisis in that context. The challenge is to deal with the climate crisis in a way that actually helps us deal with a lot of other problems at the same time. I would put it that way.
All right. Well, we'd love to talk to you. We'll have to talk to you again, Tom, because there's so much more to say. But thank you so much for being on Post Carbon Radio.
Thank you, Tom.
No problem.
I'm trying to spread the word about this immense issue, but I find it absurd why so many people are confused. Some people don't understand the weight of this problem. Act now before it gets out of hand, cause the earth is calling. I was 10 years old exposed to it. The inconvenient truth really made me concerned how it was going to affect the youth. The temp is still rising from the pollution we produce. We need to start striving for a solution to reduce. When we burn fossil fuels like coal and gasoline, we're using dirty energies when we should be using clean. When we burn, we're adding to the greenhouse effect. CO2, CH4, and N2O collect in our atmosphere. They remain up there for years and years, absorbing sun rays that come near. We need to persevere, cause this makes our planet's temp rise fast. So why can't we find a way to cut back on our greenhouse gas?
We've waited too long. Act now before the moment's gone. The situation's tough, but stay strong until
we see the dawn.
The climate's on my mind. 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 The climate's on my mind.